Welcome to Off Court, the Business of Sport podcast, where business and sports culture meet. Let's go. Kick it off, Robbie.
In this special Premiership Edition episode of the Sport and Business podcast, we're going to be hearing from Dylan Grimes. Dylan is a three-time Premiership player with Richmond in the AFL, and he's also the owner of the Mount Macedon Winery, which in this podcast, we're going to be hearing about some of the challenges that Dylan's faced and now starting to reap some of the rewards. What's up, Off Court fam? Welcome to the podcast. We have been privileged to have some amazing guests on the pod, and we've got another one with us today in Dylan Grimes, a three-time Premiership player with Richmond in the AFL and also the owner of Mount Macedon Winery, which I'm really keen to dive into more in this chat. How you doing, Dylan?
Yeah, really good. Thanks, Rob. Thanks for having me.
As I said, it's really, really good to have you here because I think you've got a really interesting story that aligns very well with this podcast. It goes without saying you're obviously an extremely accomplished and celebrated AFL footballer, but you've got this whole other, I suppose, polar opposite world that you kind of have immersed yourself in, and that is the Mount Macedon Winery. I actually remember we caught up, it would have been, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, and I believe you're at like the really early stages of getting it going, but I mean, I suppose I'd love to know how the thought of taking on this giant adventure even started to kind of come together in your mind.
Yeah, I think most professional codes are pretty big on off-field development. And from what I can gather, you know, about cricket and rugby and the sports that are around Melbourne is that everyone's kind of got the awareness of that, you know, notion that your career is only like a really short period of your overall life and the importance of, you know, being in your early to mid-20s, that critical time of, you know, finding something to do away from the field. And yeah, so for me, that journey kind of started with a few different things. I did aviation for a little while thinking that I wanted to be a pilot. And, you know, I studied quantity surveying course to take over my dad's a quantity surveyor. So to take over his business thinking that, you know, maybe that's what I should do. And yeah, never really found that I could find something that really like lit me up and really wanted, you know, cause it is hard outside of training and commitments with games and travel and stuff to go, you know, sit in a uni theater, you know, for a few hours on your day off. And you know, that gets a bit draining pretty quick if it's not something that really lights you up. And so for me, yeah, I really was, you know, curious about what I wanted to do without kind of knowing anything more than that. And then my process was a bit different, and I was kind of guided through this by our player development team. And we sort of, you know, a lot of people design, like they have a business or they have their job and they kind of design their life outside of that, like it takes up such a big chunk. And we sort of started the process from the opposite end. And I said, you know, like I really wanted to work from home. I wanted to be a small business owner. I wanted to live in the country, but within an hour and a half of Melbourne. And I knew I wanted to do something with agriculture because my family are all in agriculture, but I knew I didn't want to be a farmer full time. I didn't want that to be my sole form of income because, you know, I'd seen how hard that can be with, you know, changing markets and, you know, weather events that really just destroy a year of work. So, yeah, that was kind of the notion that I had. And then I thought, look, this is the type of areas I want to live in. This is what I want to do with my free time. And then we kind of, you know, just workshopped the idea of the type of lifestyle we wanted to have after footy finished. And yeah, so I sort of got clarity on that part before I got clarity on the business part. And then my wife now, but girlfriend at the time, was, you know, she's really passionate about, she was right on the edge of the wedding industry and she wanted to get more immersed in that. And then one day the penny kind of dropped and we thought, look, hey, why don't we have a farm that is a mixed farm so I can sort of fill my bucket with that. And Alicia, you know, maybe we could host a dozen weddings a year and something like that. And you know, have a place where family and friends can really retreat to you know, get away from the city bubble. And that was kind of the early idea. And Robbie, when I spoke to you, we were probably at that stage and not much else. And we spent about 2 to 3 years probably writing a business plan, going and seeing, you know, farms all over the place, making offers and not being able to afford the ones that we wanted. And yeah, it was sort of, it took a long time. By the, you know, since we first sat down to you know, when we actually purchased the place in 2016. So, but yeah, ever since we've been here, it's kind of just been the best decision we've ever made.
Mate, that's amazing. And I think it's a really elite mindset when you lay it out like that in terms of working backwards. Because as you said, you know, a lot of people work around, oh, well, this is my job, or this is what I do. This is how I, you know, put food on the table, and then work forwards and go, okay, well, what can I do, or where can I live? And, you know, everything else kind of follows that. Whereas, as you said, you've worked backwards and go, oh, well, this is what I want to do actually, and this is where I want to be. And then we'll make everything else work around it, which is, you know, from a mindset perspective or from a personal development point of view is absolutely elite. And you're obviously already operating in an elite environment. So I'm certain there's crossovers with that mindset.
Yeah, massive. And look, I think, and it's something that I am, you know, I'd love to get more involved with helping people kind of on that path as well, about kind of narrowing down on their opportunities outside of sport and what they want to do after sport. Because I think it's a lot easier sometimes to rule out the things or highlight the things that you don't want. Like, I knew I didn't want to wear a suit every day. I didn't want to work on Collins Street, and I didn't want to have to go back to uni for 5 or 6 years after I finished my career. I wanted to work outside with autonomy, with different stimulus. And yeah, so it was kind of, once I highlighted the things I didn't want to do, it made the things that I did want to do kind of more obvious. From that point on, I just kind of, started to say no to a lot more and started saying yes to a lot more things that were kind of, you know, right up my alley.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. So run me through, once you found the property, purchased the property, how did the business kind of come together? Obviously, you'd written, spent 2 years writing a business plan, but how did it kind of come together? How did all the pieces fit together?
Yeah, so we'd completely stretched ourselves to buy this farm beyond kind of that comfort zone where you think, yeah, we'll be all right. It was pretty nerve-wracking early days. And look, we had no idea. It was when we purchased Mount Masson Winery, it had been a winery in the early 2000s, and it had closed down somewhere after that. We're actually not entirely sure, but it was somewhere when they were trying to sell the property. A heap of the vineyard was pulled out, and the old winery shed, which they'd converted to do like cellar door tastings for the wine and the odd function or event here or there. They'd hosted weddings here as well, and that had been closed for 6 years before we took it over. So they'd put it on the market. The owners had gone into retirement. So when we came here, it was very run down, and there was a lot of work to get it up to scratch. But we settled October. I'll never forget it. It was October 2nd, 2016, which was right at the beginning of my off season. And I was like, that's it. This whole off season, I'm just going to spend the entire time renovating this place, and hopefully we can get it up and running soon. But there was just so much to do. But we thought we'll focus on the old winery shed, which was what was going to be our new restaurant. We're going to renovate that and turn it into a restaurant and wedding venue. So as we were sort of renovating, we're, you know, thinking, oh, you know, I wonder how many weddings we could sell in a year. Like, do you reckon we could maybe host, you know, 5 or 10 in one calendar year? And you know, we're renovating, and as it's kind of like for the first time in years, the gates were open to the property, and we were, you know, just so new to the place. There was family coming and going, helping out with the renos, so we just left the gates open. But what we were finding was locals and tourists in the area were just seeing the vineyard from the road and driving up the driveway, and, you know, we were in, you know, full paint gear and covered in dust, and they were asking us if we could serve them some wine. And it was at that point that we thought, maybe there's a market here for a cellar door, which was something, oddly enough, that we hadn't really considered doing. We were really targeting the wedding space, and I was really interested in the vineyard, but I'd always imagined selling the fruit rather than making the wine, if that makes sense. So there's a bit of a difference to where we ended up. But yeah, so we're renovating, people are coming up, and we thought, look, we've got some wine here. Let's, you know, like, we're pretty cash strapped at the moment. We've spent, you know, our life savings on this place and some. And so we opened up, started off as December that year. So we had 2 months of renovating, just painting really and cleaning up. And we launched with no hospitality experience. I was the cook, my brother was a cook, and Alicia was serving wine, and we were doing just grazing boards and wine and the old pizza eventually, but that wasn't initially. And it just kind of just grew, and now we've got, you know, a team of chefs and full kitchen and a product that we're really happy with.
Yeah, that's honestly amazing. So you obviously had to you had to pivot a bit because you changed your model from, oh, well, you know, we might just sell the unfinished product to, all right, we're actually going to make the product. How did you, like, where did you learn to even make one? I mean, it feels like, you know, that's not something, you know, you just YouTube and you come up with a skill. How did you kind of, how did that even happen?
The process of that we follow, so that basically we've got about 6,500 vines on site, and they're cool climate. We're actually the coldest vineyard in the coldest region on the mainland of Australia. So, like, that means the most challenging growing conditions. And to put it on top of that, we're almost 700 meters above sea level. So you've just got, like, this microclimate where, you know, it's snowing a few times a year. We've got probably, yeah, six dumpings of snow throughout the year, and it's average temperature is probably about, you know, 5 to 7 degrees cooler than Melbourne. So if you think on a bitters winter's day in Melbourne, it's a fair bit colder up here. But yeah, the process that we followed was, all right, let's firstly assess where the vineyard's at. And it was pretty run down at that point. It was planted in 89. So the vines are about 30 years old. And yeah, starting to show their signs of age. And first things first, we hired a viticulturist, which is someone that can basically walk into your vineyard and tell you every single problem that's going on, from infrastructure, so post, trellis, dripper wires, even the soil, and then what's going on with the vines. So what do they need from a TLC point of view? And we just set out a plan. Honestly, we had no budget, but we just set out a plan of what we wanted to do and how we were going to renovate the vineyard to get back to producing, you know, some of the best cool climate crops that the mainland can. And yeah, it's been a long process because one thing you don't realize about wine is, let's say you plant a vine today, it's 4 years before you get a single grape off it. And then after that, it's another year in winemaking process. So it's a 5-year delay between concept to final product. So yeah, it is very much a labor of love. It can be, if you're not careful, it can be a money pit to no return, but you've got to be really mindful of you know, where the business is at and where it's going, because it's really easy to lose touch of where the vineyard's at, and it just eats away at your cash flow big time because it's such a long time delay between returns.
You want to be pretty good at planning. You certainly got to be playing the long game when it's a 5-year turnaround between start and finish. You mentioned that it's obviously, I mean, it goes without saying, but the capital requirements to start a winery are significant. But was there ever a moment where you were like, what the bloody hell have we got ourselves into?
Oh yeah, so many times. And like, I should point out, like, I grew up on a hobby farm. I had no like tractor experience. I had no heavy machinery experience. I'd never worked in a vineyard before. My family had owned an olive grove. That was the closest thing to a vineyard that I'd worked in. And even then, I was a kid, so I was, you know, barely doing the work. So yeah, there was so many times. Like, I can remember there's this one time. So our wine's made not on site. So we grow the fruit throughout the whole year, harvest the fruit, and then ship it off to a local winery who make the wine, and then we get the return product with the Mount Masson Winery label on there. We contract out the winemaking, so we essentially pay them to follow a sort of style guide, a brief of what we want to do with the wine. And so anyway, that our delivery of wine was coming back, and, you know, it's somewhere wholesale. It's probably, you know, maybe $30,000 worth that was arriving this day of wine. So this is like a whole stock for the next kind of few months. And the truck driver arrived, and I'd never contemplated how you get the wine off a truck. I was just like, yes, so excited. We got this new wine, our first wine coming back. Got to get it off the truck. And I remember he rocked up and he says, "Where's your forklift?" And I was like, "Oh no, we've got a forklift, but I have no idea how to drive it. I don't even know if it runs. It just came with the farm." It was the back of a shed, and I walk in there and I look at this thing, and it was like I was looking at like a spaceship. I needed to figure out quick smart, like in an instant, how to drive this thing, and I needed to be able to get $30,000 worth of stock off the back of this truck without breaking the truck, the wine, or the forklift. It was moments like that where you're like, afterwards the adrenaline has just been absolutely soaring through your body, and you sit back and you're like, what the hell am I doing? I'm so far out of my depth. But thankfully those moments, look, they still happen, but they happen much, much less. And not as intense. There's times when, you know, you feel, I suppose, you know, every business owner has probably felt this in startup phase, that imposter syndrome, like someone's going to figure out that I don't really know what I'm doing. But, you know, I think that's, it's like the best, it's the most stressful way to learn, but it is just the best way to learn because, you know, now I can drive a forklift. I'm qualified to drive a forklift now, which I wasn't at the beginning. And yeah, it's just been a huge process of first time driving a forklift, first time driving a tractor around a vineyard. And yeah, the list kind of goes on and on.
Yeah, for sure. And it's not on the same scale, but when we had our first container delivery at Uncle Jack, we were the same, and the driver rocked up and he's like, well, where's your forklift? Like, how are you going to unload the container? I was like, I hadn't thought that far. So we ended up jumping in and taking them out. Like the boxes are quite small, and you think of it, a container's like seriously huge. And, you know, one by one, box by box, we ended up having to take them out and create like a bit of a production line in getting them out. And the truck driver, you know, they're used to like dumping it. Someone comes in, forklift, done, see ya. Ended up waiting 2 hours and copping a fair bit of it.
He would have been happy about that.
Yeah, he would have been stoked. It just really set him up for the rest of the day. But yeah, it's funny how you just, like some of those moments in the early days, you look back and you're like, well, what were we actually, like, what did you think was going to happen? You know, but hindsight's 20/20. But it's all part of starting a business, and, you know, startup land's all very fun.
Everyone kind of goes above and beyond in that startup phase. You know, I'm sure you've probably got 30 stories of Uncle Jack where you guys just had to just grit your teeth and get through whatever was needed to be done. And it sounds corny, but honestly, until you're at that point where it's like, well, no one else is going to do it unless it's me, you have no choice. You just kind of get on with it.
Yeah. And I think you're exactly right about, you know, you mentioned taking those hits a little bit harder and they're quite intense. And I think for me anyway, it was, I kind of took those hits really, really hard and kind of took them personally, which in hindsight, you know, from a business perspective, you don't really want to be taking an emotional kind of stance when things go wrong, because things are going to go wrong whether you do everything. And, you know, it's like playing footy, you could do everything right and still lose. So you kind of got to kind of have that, you know, resilient, but also developing a bit of an unemotional approach to business, because, you know, I don't think emotion and money or emotion and impulse decisions turn out too well generally.
No, I completely agree.
Yeah. But I mean, in some ways for me, you're living like this, the most idyllic lifestyle, the most idyllic life on earth. Successful AFL player with an absolute sanctuary in the mountains, creating wine and doing what you love. Do you have to pinch yourself sometimes?
I think like every year for about the last 5 years, I've put on my New Year's resolution that I'm going to be more in the moment, like more, I'm going to celebrate the little things more. I think you can definitely get caught up in yeah, particularly when you're starting off, like what's next? That you tick off one thing and you don't even sit in that space of how good is that? Like, that's amazing. We've made some progress. You so quickly move to, you know, what's the next challenge? What's the next mountain? What do we have to do? And I never really, we've been here for just under 5 years. And I don't think I've ever really grown out of that kind of startup mentality about kind of that relentless nature of what's next. It's a good thing. It's a bad thing at the same time, because yeah, you're not really ever, you don't stagnate too much. So I'm not really good at switching off that much. It definitely comes with its costs and challenges of being, you know, in a business that, you know, where I live here, you know, most of the time, at least, you know, 5 days a week. And, you know, I'm constantly around the farm, and there's like, you know, driving up the driveway, I've seen like 4 things that I really want to get done that day. And yeah, like that was, it just often, you know, the time off or the time to reflect gets pushed back down the to-do list of things that, you know, more of a priority. And there's not a day that I don't think, you know, I'm a bit bonkers for doing this while still playing. But having said that, it was the best decision we ever made to start really pursuing a passion and a career outside of football, because I think it really did make a big difference in my on-field playing career. But the stress that I have, or the lack of stress that I have, I should say, about finishing my career and, you know, say if I got delisted or whatever the scenario was, I had to retire, you know, this year or the next or whenever, I would be so comfortable and even really excited about the next phase of life. So that's probably the part that I am most grateful for, I think.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I think you've obviously set yourself up so well in terms of having a real clear purpose and, you know, you're obviously very driven outside of footy, which is, you know, super refreshing. I know with Brandon Ellis, who obviously your premiership teammate and my business partner, he always said that. And I think, I don't know if it's something, you know, particularly based around the Richmond culture, but having something outside of footy where he could really kind of sink his teeth into. And he kind of echoed the same thing where, you know, if he had something that he could do that with outside of footy, and, you know, in that particular example was Uncle Jack at the time, he kind of felt like his on-field performance was better because he wasn't constantly immersed in thinking about, you know, oh, I could have done this on the weekend or I should have done that. So he comes into training or the next game with a much clearer mindset about what he's doing.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, like, I mean, you know what it's like with work when you've got, you know, you could have the worst day ever the day before or even the morning, worst morning ever, and you get into the office and then things are just a buzz and there's so much going on, so much to do that you kind of, it really makes you forget about what's happened for me on field. And, you know, win, loss or draw, injury, all that sort of stuff. It really does. It's a really helpful distraction, I think, for me and my football.
Hey guys, if you're enjoying this podcast, I would love if you could screenshot it, chuck it up on your Instagram story and tag us at offcourt.sport. All right, let's get back to it. You've been bouncing around in COVID hubs for the last 18 months. You know, it's obviously, personally, it's very tough, but there's also significant, you know, business ramifications. How have you kind of felt that and how have you kind of been dealing with that over the last 18 months?
I mean, football and hospitality have been two terrible industries to be part of, really, in COVID, because football, we've been, last year we were on 50% pay, and then this year and living in a hub scenario in Queensland, and then this year we've kind of been shipped all over the place. So not ideal situations, but having said that, they've both been, you know, like, they're really, in the reality of things, we've still been playing and it's been pretty good. So I'm sort of painting a bit of a negative picture on something that's actually been quite positive. But yeah, there's been some challenges definitely with the business, you know, like we're a wedding and events venue, and in COVID, obviously that's a huge impact. Probably some of the worst phone calls we've had to make are to brides that have had to either move weddings or, you know, cut a guest list down from 130 down to, you know, 80. Conversations like that are just really, really tough. And particularly when you've got, you know, family coming from overseas or interstate that now can't come, or yeah, it's just a really kind of emotional time for everyone involved in COVID, in lockdown or wherever you are. There's not a single person really, I don't think, that hasn't been affected. But then, yeah, for me, kind of the added layer on top of that was, you know, managing like the needs of staff as well. Like, one thing we were really concerned about was, you know, are all our staff, particularly our part-time staff and casual staff, are they well supported in this time? Because their income really stops as soon as the door closes, because they're not on a salary, so they only get paid for the hours they work. So we completely changed things up in those moments, and we're doing it tomorrow as well, where we've got the hospo team. They're out in the vineyard at the moment. They're pruning in the vineyard, and it's a way of kind of keeping the MMW culture and staff together at a time that's really challenging. But yeah, having said that, it's been the good thing. There's some good things and there's some bad things about having a really diverse business, because if you think about us, you know, there's the event side of the business, there's wine and farming production, there's livestock as well here, We've got the restaurant and then the cellar door. So there's a few moving parts, but when one part gets closed down, we kind of just turn the knobs on the other parts and wind it up. So at the moment, our focus is on the vineyard and doing as much work as we can out there, while farming is still an essential service. And then, yeah, as you know, hospitality starts to ramp up, we'll probably slow down the vineyard a little bit and kind of just manage the workflow that way. But yeah, it's been logistically a real challenge, and I'm really hoping, leading into this wedding season, which sort of starts in spring for us, that there are just I would love to not have to cancel or change or postpone or even reduce guest numbers for any of the upcoming weddings that we're hosting.
Yeah, definitely. And I suppose having that diversification as far as, you know, business revenue goes is kind of, you know, a little bit of a blessing during COVID, where, as you say, you can kind of turn the knobs up and down depending on, you know, what you're able to do, which is pretty important. I wouldn't mind asking you about that. So last year, the 50% pay cut deal with the AFL players. You know, I know, and I'm sure you'll agree that, you know, AFL players are in a privileged position from a financial perspective, but people live within their means. You know, if you take a 5-year deal and, you know, you think you're going to be on X amount of money, you go and, let's just say, you go and get a mortgage, or, you know, you go and buy a business and you think that's going to be all hunky-dory and that's what's going to happen. You know, AFL players aren't immune to financial stress, of course. So how, in your opinion, I mean, how is that kind of played out? Was there any, I mean, I know it's, you know, unbelievable circumstances, but, you know, what was the kind of support or the I suppose there must have been some pushback as well.
Yeah, I think, like, initially there was the, you know, there was the idea that it was just, like, it wasn't going to happen. The first time we heard it, it was like, no, they can't, like, they can't reduce our pay. This is a contract that we've signed. This, and then there's the kind of weeks, this is early COVID, as the weeks kind of roll on, you realize the position that the AFL was in. It was like, well, there's no other option. We have to kind of keep the game alive. Otherwise, there's not going to be anything to return to. So, yeah, and your point around financial stress, I suppose the thing that kind of helped was that, you know, we're all in the same position. It wasn't as though, you know, previously you think about history, someone goes through financial circumstance, like financial trouble. Normally it's you're isolated and you're on your own. It's a private issue. But I think the fact that we're all kind of in it together, we're living with one another, we were able to kind of help each other kind of get through and talk about those things that we were facing. So it became less of like a personal thing. I think there's a bit of shame involved around, you know, struggling financially that you don't want to really talk about. But yeah, we were able to kind of bounce ideas off. But honestly, the AFL were incredible, really, and the AFLPA more so, were incredible in the support that they offered. So they offer a financial service. So there was Zoom meetings going on all the time about that. And I think as the weeks kind of rolled out, you know, the government had released incentives like, you know, delaying mortgage repayments and things like that. So yeah, and for business owners, you know, JobKeeper came out and that made it easier to keep staff on. And there was a bunch of government grants that you could apply for depending on your sector. And yeah, I think initially it was a lot more grim than what it kind of turned out in. But yeah, having said that, no doubt there'd be some stories, like some really challenging stories about players. You know, as you said, you live within your means and you think something's guaranteed until it gets taken away. So picture a player that's just bought a house, very first home, and they're, you know, they're the players probably most at risk that are on a modest income, bought their first home, and just, yeah, now that income has just been completely split in two. That's a stressful situation for anyone, I think. And yeah, luckily the game's bounced back really well, and here we are back on full pay and still playing, even though in really challenging circumstances for everyone.
For sure. And I think, you know, footy fans alike, including myself, are very appreciative of everyone involved last year during, you know, particularly the Victorian lockdowns or the Melbourne lockdowns that, you know, were months on end, and, you know, having the footy on, you know, on the weekends, or, you know, I think we at one point we were doing, you know, almost every single day or every single night in the hub, was a real, like, you know, it was a real boost for everyone, to be honest, to be able to just sit down after a tough day, you know, not knowing what was happening and just being able to watch the footy. I know, like, I'm very appreciative that we did have that during that time, and I'm sure a lot of footy fans are very, very thankful that that was able to eventuate. So I know I certainly appreciate some of the sacrifices that everyone's had to make, you know, to get through that tough period. But, you know, looking forward, what's kind of the plans for the Mount Macedon Winery? Have you got any new products in the works, or what's kind of the, what are you working on?
Yeah, so it's a pretty fluid business, in a sense that there's always kind of something happening. We've never really outgrown that startup feel of, or really that early renovation feel of, you know, like you hop on the, we walked into the farm and there was like trees down over fences. There was like, you know, just basically every building needed renovating, and it was like we never really kind of outgrown that. So yeah, for us, launching a new cellar door space. So at the moment we've got our restaurant and cellar door in the one building, and now our cellar door is transitioning into a completely separate building. So that'll increase our capacity, which is great for COVID, you know, restrictions and in space requirements and things like that. So then, yeah, in the next week, actually, a week from tomorrow, starting a kitchen renovation. So doing, yeah, basically a complete remodel of our commercial kitchen. And then, yeah, some more kind of exciting projects, because they're a little bit boring. One thing that we've been really passionate about, and was a huge kind of driving force as to why we wanted to buy a place like this, is we wanted to be able to grow our own food on site, and, you know, hopefully one day have kids and be able to share that produce with you know, family and friends. And then the idea kind of grew from there. Could we grow food and bring people here and provide for like the more broader community? And so what that looks like for us is, you know, we're about to get into planting, you know, a full set of market gardens that'll be year-round produce, an orchard with mixed fruit and citrus, and also a little bit of my own heritage, some olives as well for an olive grove. And the idea about that is I really want people to be able to come on site and see food in kind of three different stages. So stage one is the actual raw produce. You can walk outside and see the fruit on the vines or the veggies in the ground, the animals in the paddocks. And stage two is in the cellar door or providor, so you can buy some of that food and take it home for your family. You can, you know, experience what real quality slow grown paddock to plate food tastes like. And then stage three is you can experience that paired with estate grown wines made by a really talented team of chefs, and all farm to plate, so entirely grown here. I'd love for people to be able to see those three stages and be able to connect a bit with the story of food and also other local growers. That's something that we're really passionate about. And yeah, the wine list is always growing. We're about to put in another 8 acres of vineyard up here, so more than doubling our current vineyard. And yeah, it's been a process. It's been a long time coming. But yeah, it's been cool to kind of just inch our way closer to that goal. But yeah, it's right around the corner, which is super exciting.
Yeah, that's amazing. Sounds like you've got all bases covered. So where can people find out more about the winery and get involved?
Yeah, so pretty much all the usual places, Facebook, Instagram, our website, Mount Macedon Winery. Or better yet, come out and see it for themselves. We're about an hour away from Melbourne. And yeah, there's plenty to do up here and lots of local vineyards and wineries as well. So you make a bit of a wine tour out of it and see a few great places as well and try some really quality wine.
Love that. Dylan, thank you so much for coming on the Off Court Pod. It's been a pleasure and super interesting to hear your story about the Mount Macedon Winery. It's you know, certainly opened my eyes to the industry, and I'm sure everyone listening in will get a lot out of this conversation. So thank you again for coming on.
No worries, Rob. Good to see you, mate. Thanks for having me.